Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Well done. Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of INFORM, the Commonwealth Club's Innovation Lab. You can find INFORM online at informsf.org. I'm Kara Swisher, co-executive editor of Recode. And tonight we're talking to Biz Stone, whose new book is Things a Little Bird Told Me, Confessions of a Creative Mind, if you do say so yourself. But most people know Biz as the co-founder of Twitter, one of the co-founders of Twitter, one of the 53 co-founders. And we also know him from his business card reading BizStone, Genius. His new company is a mobile social questions app called Jelly. And in general, he's been a really interesting player on the tech scene over the last few years. It's been my pleasure to get to know him over the many years I've covered Twitter and other things he's been doing. But he's a really interesting and unusual entrepreneur, much more creative than the average entrepreneur. And so we're going to talk a little bit about his book, Personal Stories About Creativity, and then we'll get to questions from the audience. Sound good?
That sounds really great.
Great. Okay.
Thanks for taking the time to do this.
Oh, anytime. You're such a nice guy. Why wouldn't I? But on that note. I read a lot of the reviews of the book because I like to read the reviews and how people react to this book, because this is a really nice book. This is like most of the internet books are not so nice. It's all about the fighting, and a lot of the Twitter books have been about that.
Yeah.
But this one of the things from the Washington Post really struck me. I'm going to read it. Stone is an exceedingly positive and upbeat person whose account of how he made it big by being nice guy you will find either uplifting or unbearable, depending on your disposition. So,
that sounds about right.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about what you were setting out to do here in the book. What was the conceptual idea of writing a book now?
Well, for the last decade or more, I've been giving this. It started out as a master class, what they call a master class at Oxford University, which sounds really fancy, but it's really just a lecture.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got miraculously invited back and over and over and over again. But then, and so as a result, it grew. And then I started getting invited to do the lecture at all different sorts of events.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from leadership summits, nonprofit things, educations, summits, you name it. And what I discovered was that the stories, it's basically a collection of personal stories. You know,
mm-hmm.
they say write what you know. And at the end of every story, there's an aphorism or a lesson learned or something that I took from my youth and transposed it into my business career and found that it was very useful. And what was really amazing was that everyone from high school students all the way up to CEOs would come up to me afterwards and say, you know, Biz, this thing you said about creativity or this perspective you chose to share about opportunity really changed the way that I'm thinking about doing this or that. And I'm talking about high school kids all the way to CEOs. And
mm-hmm.
so I was like, well, this is crazy. Like, this, that's a range, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then someone, it wasn't my idea, someone suggested I write a book. And then it was obvious that if I was going to write a book, I would just turn the lecture into a book. Because the lecture was Things a Little Bird Told Me. And so that's what I did. I just said, well, that's a great idea, you know. And I thought maybe I'll turn the lecture into a book and then I won't have to do the lecture anymore. But it turns out if you write a book,
you have to do a lot of
everyone
lectures.
Everyone wants you to.
Exactly.
So that was yet another mistake.
Yeah. So in general, what was the purpose here? I mean, you do have a lot of talking about the connected society. You always were the sunnier part of Twitter. Not that it's the darkest place in the world, but there's a lot of drama at Twitter.
Yeah.
Compared to many companies. There's a little telenovela over there for a long time.
Yeah.
But one of your things was sort of positivity and looking forward. What was the goal of the book itself?
Well, the goal of the book is really just the themes in the book are familiar. They're not like, you know, opportunity, creativity, failure. These things are like, yeah, we've we read about these things all the time. The idea behind the lecture and the book was to share my perspective on these things, you know. And my perspective tends to be, you know, hallucinogenically optimistic or incredibly aspirational. And so the idea really is to, like, allow readers to look at the world through my eyes and potentially come away with it with a new perspective on their own life. It's not like I'm advocating everyone quit their job and do a startup. You know, that's what everyone should. Or drop out of school and do this or that. It's just, how do you apply the things that I learned to what you're doing now? And it might mean quit your job, but it might just mean, you know, find that you hate your job, but there's one bright spot in your job that you really love.
Which you talk about.
Yeah, I call it bright spot theory. There's always something good you can find, and then you just say, what's good about that, and how can I expand that and do more of that? And so
Right. That's
the idea, is basically, you know, try to view the world through the way that I look at it, and if it's helpful, great. If the lessons aren't helpful, then maybe you'll have a laugh reading about, like, you know, a lot of the times I screwed up and the stupid stuff I did.
Okay.
But the lessons I learned.
Well, we can laugh about that soon.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your background and how you got to Twitter. Let's start. We get to talk about that, and we'll go into bright spot theory, which I thought was an interesting one.
Well, how far back do you want to go?
Well, as far as you want.
Let's go. Well,
let's start with Twitter. How you got there? I think most people do know the story, but not as well.
Okay. It's fun to tell the story of how I ended up being an internet entrepreneur in 1999. That's a fun story with the boxes and everything, but I can skip to the Twitter part if you want.
No, go ahead.
Okay. So when I got this great scholarship for excellence in the arts at UMass Boston, and it was really good. And I got a job on the side moving heavy boxes from the attic to the lobby of a publishing company called Little Brown & Company, which is based in Boston on Beacon Hill. And I had grown up, my friend Mark Ginsburg's dad was a dentist, and he had one of the early Macs, and so, you know, by the time I was doing this job, the art department of Little Brown & Company was just switching from spray glue and X-Acto knives and, you know, old school stuff to desktop publishing on Macs.
Mm-hmm.
So they all went out to lunch one day. And I snuck onto the art director's workstation, and I designed a jacket. And I printed it out, and I matted it up, and I slipped it in with the other ones to go off for approval at sales and editorial in New York. And then I went back to the movie in the boxes, and when the art director came back a few days later...
This is like a Matt Damon movie.
He said... He said, who designed this cover? And I said, because it was chosen. And I said, me. And he was like, the box kid.
Right.
And so then it was Steve, this guy's name was Steve Snyder, who became my mentor. And he offered me a job as a designer. And so I had this decision to make. Do I drop out of university, which is this great ride that I've been offered, or do I, you know, the thought process in my head was two things. One, don't people go to school so they can get the job, this job? I mean, aren't I skipping 2 years or 3 years? And then the other thing was, I'm gonna be sitting with this guy every day, mentoring with this accomplished art director who's 30 years older than me, just knows a lot of stuff. So I decided it's totally worth it. And I dropped out of college. First day of work, he beckons me in wordlessly to his office. I go up to the desk. He reaches behind him without looking. Takes out a Pantone color guide, flips through the browns into the mochas, tears one out, puts it on his desk, slides it across with his finger and says, that's how I take my coffee. And I was like, oh, my God. And then I'm instantly like...
At least it was a stylish way of telling you you're a loser.
I'm instantly thinking, like, I got to go to Dunkin' Donuts and see if the lady can... she's not going to do... And he was like, what are you... You think I'm that kind of a jerk? Of course it is. So he turned out to be this wonderful guy. I apprenticed with him, basically, for 2-3 years. And he's a dear friend of mine. You know, I grew up without a dad, so... It wasn't just graphic design. It was like everything. How did you know when it was time to propose to your wife? You know, how much did you ask for your first job, and like why, and how did you figure that out? And he's like, why are you asking me all these questions? And I'm like, because you're old and you know things. And so we became really, really good friends, and we still are. And And so from what happened, just basically, and from him, there's a lot of lessons in the book from him that he taught me about creativity and all these sort of things. But to jump fast forward to Twitter, what happened was because he filled my head with all these tales of how he had his own studio before he took an art director job because it was more steady for a family. And I said, I want to do that. So I started my own studio, but I quickly realized I couldn't just design book cover. It wasn't enough money. So I learned, it was the mid to late 90s, and I realized if I taught myself web design, I could really rake it in. So I started doing websites.
Right.
And then by then, my friends graduated college, went into consulting, hated consulting, and said, hey, you're doing websites. Let's start a web company. That's how vague it was, web company.
Right. So, worldwide web company.
Yeah, let's start a web company. So we started this early social blogging network called Zanga.com in 1999. It was kind of a, you know, like a live journal and or like a rival to Blogger. And that's how I ended up knowing who Evan Williams was. We never met, but I followed his blog. I really, like, you know, I don't know how to phrase it. Like, I had an intellectual crush on him. You know, I just really agreed with.
It's called a man crush.
Man crush. Okay, but I didn't. But I didn't even know him.
Right. That's how those go.
So I just thought, I was like, this guy is great. I love all the stuff this guy's writing. He's really on the money, and then.
You talk about the book. You wrote him a note saying I should be.
Well, what happened was after Zanga didn't work out, and I ended up racking up all this credit card debt because I was paying my rent with my credit card and everything, and I ended up having to move back in my mom's basement. I was like in my mom's basement with a blog that's BizStone Genius, and like
What was the lesson from that? The creativity lesson. Just curious.
From what?
From that, living in your mom's basement with a Genius card.
Well, the lesson there was like was basically fake it till you make it. Like. Mm-hmm. Like, I created this fictitional company called Genius Labs. We have unlimited wealth, and we work on everything. We work on Japanese hybrid air transit. We make movies. We do serious work for NASA. We do whatever. It was always like this crazy. It was obviously a joke. I hope some people might have thought it was real, but and I had this persona was just this incredibly
erudite.
Yeah, like a Tony Stark. You know that. And meanwhile, I'm just like hunched over a computer in my mom's basement. But so what happened was, when Google acquired Blogger, I sent Evan Williams a note. Again, I'd never met him. I found his email. I emailed him. And I said, you know, I always felt like I was the missing seventh member of your team. So if you guys ever think about hiring, you know, maybe you can think about me. And it turns out he had been reading my blog all along too.
Oh.
So it wasn't just one-sided thing.
Crush, right?
It was a double man crush.
Okay.
And
those are the best kind.
Okay. And so he pulled some serious strings over. He said, "Why don't you come work at Google?" And I was like, "Cool, all right, I got a job." Because I'd never been on a job interview before, so I just thought that was it. You got it, like boom, you're in.
Right.
You know?
And boom, you were.
Turns out it was like he pulled so many strings. That was a whole story about how I got to work there. But basically, I didn't meet Evan until he picked me up at the airport at SFO to go to work.
So easy way to get a job, though, in a weird, in another.
And then, just you know, the rest of it is.
Right, well,
I left Google. We started Twitter.
You didn't like Google, correct? You didn't.
No, I love. I yeah. People.
You've told me that. That's why I'm saying.
Well. No, I
hated it. Was I think.
No, no.
Those
Google,
robots.
Google,
I believe those robots were in there.
Google was Genius Labs. That's what was so crazy cool about it.
Right.
It's just that there's a fundamental philosophical difference between myself and Google, and it comes down to a simple ordered list. Number one, in my mind, people. Number two, technology. And I don't think that's the way that they have their list or the way they think about the world, and which is fine because they do amazing stuff. Like, don't get me wrong. I can't live in a world without Google. I use Google every day. I depend upon it. And they must keep doing their jobs because without Google, the internet is broken. So I loved it, but when Evan left, I had another one of those like drop out of college moments where I asked my wife, I said, what did we move to California to do? Mm-hmm. Did we move to California for me to work at Google, or did we move to California so that I could work with Evan?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer was work with Evan, even though by that time I had totally was set at Google. Like,
right.
Google went, I got there before the IPO, they went IPO, I had all these stocks, I was getting myself out of debt,
right.
And they didn't
the
know
organic
to, they didn't know
stand,
to,
the daily and everything.
They didn't, right, everything was free and crazy, and they didn't know what to do with me, so they decided I had no boss, and yet I got like all the bonuses and everything, and I was like, this is crazy, I could not even go in and nobody would notice.
Yeah.
And
you noticed that. There.
Just as I got it worked out, I decided that I needed to quit because I wanted to work with Evan.
Right.
And it didn't matter what it was. It happened to be Odeo, but it didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And then that, you know, I'll stop talking, but there's lessons learned from Odeo and stuff, too.
So they started a company, Odeo, which was not successful.
Yeah, it wasn't really successful.
It was a podcast. It was not successful.
It
really.
Was a podcasting. It was a podcast. It was, again, like this idea. It was too broad. We said, let's start a podcasting company. So we made a recording studio on the browser. We made a directory of podcasts. We made all this stuff, everything, not just one part of it, everything.
Right.
And then Apple was like, let's put podcasting in iTunes. And we were like, that's a good place for it to be. But ultimately, it wasn't Apple that doomed us, really, because Evan, smart guy that he is, and good-looking, wonderful person, he actually said, okay, well, here's what we're going to do. And he came up with this, you know, pivot that would, you know, work around the fact that Apple got into the business, and we would be fine. And we were going to, this actually was going to be better because we were going to focus. And that's when we had yet another one of these moments where we went out to dinner together, and I said, Evan, I read, you know, the memo you sent to the company about how we can do this, and I think if we do your plan, we are going to totally be like the kings of podcasting. He's like, wow, you think it's that good? I was like, yeah, we'll be the kings of podcasting. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay. And then I said, but here's my question. Do you want to be the king of podcasting?
And it's like being the
and
king
then
of
he was like, oh my God, I don't. This was a really powerful lesson. Neither of us podcasted. Mm-hmm. We didn't listen to podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't care about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those
Therefore,
things.
Therefore, podcasting.
It was one of those things that we thought other people would like, but you know. I mean, there was a kernel in there that was, we're going to democratize radio, just like, you know, Blogger democratized,
right,
making web pages for everybody. But the key lesson, the reason it really failed, was because we weren't emotionally invested in in our work. We didn't care about the actual work. So that's the key difference between Odeo and Twitter, was once we started Twitter, there was an emotional investment, and that carries you through everything.
Right,
that
right,
puts
which is
you
what
like
you're
that
about.
Makes you impenetrable because you don't hear you. Everything is like water off a duck's
so
back.
You're one of the most famous. Twitter is one of the most famous pivots. Pivot's a word they use in Silicon Valley for fail and then figure something else out.
Change. Yeah. Well, it wasn't even a pivot as much as it was. We tried to find a buyer for Odeo. We couldn't find a buyer, and Evan told me we can't find it. Nobody even wants to buy the company. We're screwed. And I was like, yeah, no, there's a buyer. And he was like, I just told you there isn't a buyer. Why do you do that? And I was like, but you're a rich guy. You could buy it. And he was like, I guess I could. But he was like, is that weird? Like, that's kind of weird. Like, why would I buy my own failing company back from the investors? Are people going to think that, like, that's weird? And then he was like, all right. It's my money, but let's you and me say we're both doing it together in case it goes south. And I was like, sure, whatever. So we formed this company called Obvious, and Obvious bought Odeo, which included the side project Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
We had raised $5 million for Odeo. We had only spent two. So basically, Evan bought, And then about a year later, Evan found a Canadian firm to buy the Odeo, the website and the technology for $1 million. So Evan basically bought Twitter for $1 million.
Right, right.
And it's now worth $25 billion or something.
So
that was pretty smart.
That was smart.
Very good looking, smart.
That's the key to it, good looking and smart. So you, in this pivot, you had a lot of different founders, and a lot of it's been depicted, the beginnings of Twitter, in various books, including Nick's book
yeah.
and others. You have sort of a different take here. It's less dramatic in your, although there's some moments where Dick Costo keeps saying fucking this and fucking
yeah,
that.
Well, he tends to swear
he
a
does
lot.
Swear.
Yeah.
But your depiction is a little more benign than a lot of the others, and there was a lot of drama there. I mean, there was among all of you.
There were a lot of changes. Yeah, there were a lot of
Why
changes.
Why was that? I have to say, more than any other company I covered, Twitter really was highly emotional, I would say.
Well, yeah, but the thing is, here's the thing, though. If you're emotionally invested in what you're doing, it's very emotional. Mm-hmm. Evan would get stomach aches when the service went down and stuff. I mean, his mentality was like directly tied. No, really, it's like his feelings were directly tied to the product. I mean, you couldn't separate these things, I forgot what the question was, though.
How come it was more
all the change and everything,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
So I actually, it was my idea that Jack be the CEO in the first place because mm-hmm. Evan was like, I'll just be interim CEO because he really wanted a break. He'd done Google, then he sort of fell into Odeo he wanted to take a break. And then mm-hmm. we started doing Twitter and it was like turning into a thing and he was like, you're like, I'm exhausted, mm-hmm. you know, I guess I'll be interim CEO. And I was like, interim, that sounds wishy-washy. Let's just make someone the CEO. Mm-hmm. How about Jack? And he was like, do you think he wants to do it? And I was mm-hmm. like, what CEO? It's like seven people. Like,
come on.
All he has to do is sign some stuff. Like, it's nothing. And if he needs any help, he's got you, he's got me, he's got whatever. Like, we'll just help him.
Right.
And
great corporations begin.
And Jack was like,
whatever.
Really, me? Huh?
Yeah.
And he had to think about it. And then he said, yeah. And then, you know, then there were all these changes. And my take on this, like you said, there's mostly a positive view here. I really think that everyone was always trying to do what they thought was the best thing for Twitter. I don't think there was... I do not think that people were doing malicious things. I think every board member, everyone was like, what's best? I think this is the best thing we can do. Mm-hmm. So my view of who took the CEO job was like, who was the right person for the job at the right time?
I see.
And I said, Twitter's like this living thing, and it needs what it needs when it needs it.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like we did it right, kind of. Like.
Right. So that wasn't unusual. It
didn't feel like that.
Sometimes it came off like a hipster Game of Thrones at some point.
Yeah,
you know what
yeah,
I mean? Like,
for sure.
You know, very sensitive men all over the place.
No, people have even said that, Game of Thrones. Yeah,
yeah.
Like it
but,
was
but,
as if...
But it was more benign. It wasn't benign. It was sort of...
Well, nobody wanted to not be CEO anymore, really. It's not like everyone was like, oh, you should really... No, please, you. I mean, you know... it was a little bit more tough than that. But
why didn't you? Did you? Was that ever
no,
a possibility
I,
for you?
No, I didn't feel. I was the creative guy, and I always felt that I was sort of the Oscar-winning supporting actor to whoever was in charge.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, because Jack and I were very similar people. Like they're very pensive. They're quiet.
Evan and Jack.
What did I say?
You said you and Jack. Because you're not anything like
Jack
Dorsey.
No, Evan and Jack. They're very similar. They're, you know, speak when spoken to, think through the, you know, Evan and I used to do TV interviews and they'd be like, so Evan, is Twitter going to be profitable? And Evan would go, you know, and I was like, oh my God, Evan, here's what you do. Is Twitter going to be yes? And then figure out,
right.
This is TV, you have 12
right.
seconds.
Right.
But he was honestly just thinking like, well,
let me see your Jack Dorsey impression then, if you just did the Evan Williams one. Same thing.
Jack Dorsey is more like so they're very similar, and they always needed sort of this counterweight that was, you know, more funny or more creative. You know, my thing was always I would talk really fast and I would have all these different ideas, and both of them, to their credit, they would let me be in the clouds.
Right. You did most of the forward-facing, the PR, the
marketing. I did a lot of the PR, but on the product side, they would let me go into the clouds, and they would just let me, they would listen to me, and they would grant me that. You know, both Evan and Jack, if I were to say, just for a second, imagine there's no gravity, they would be like, okay. Instead of saying, what are you talking about? There is gravity. They would be like, okay, fine, go. And I would just, and then they would listen to me, and then they would be like, oh, wait a minute. They would sort of digest it, and the next day they'd be like, something in the middle there has merit.
idiotic thing you said.
Yeah, and I was like, I said that? That's smart. And then they would take it and they would like say, like, yeah, we can grow this. You know, so.
Were you surprised by the popularity of it?
Of course.
Away from all the, what do you think was at the heart of that at the beginning? And then I'm just curious to know.
Well,
what
it was slow to, I mean, Twitter was very slow to take off.
Right.
It's not like we, you know, it's not like these days with the companies that are just like, boom. We had to claw our way to even just 1 million people using the service.
Mm-hmm.
It's
because most people didn't get it or understand.
Most people didn't get it, but also it's because Twitter and Facebook weren't really around to amplify that. Word of mouth was really just word of mouth.
Right.
Like actual mouths, not tweets. And now when things, you know, companies come along like
it's on Twitter.
Boom, Twitter and Facebook news feeds. It's just like everyone wants it. You know, like let's try it out. Like when we launched Jelly, we had twice the accounts created in 24 hours than an entire year of Twitter. And I was
so
like,
Twitter needed
whoa.
Twitter to become famous, right? Kind of thing.
I mean, it would have helped if there was but it also would have hurt because then there would have already been Twitter.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I mean, why did it take off? You know. It was hilarious to me that people would go on Twitter, and they would go on their blog and they would say, "Here's why Twitter is so stupid." I'm going to go on and on about how stupid it is and everything. I'm like, you're kind of proving that you want it, because you want a way to express yourself and say how stupid it is.
Right, right. It's true.
So
I think people got caught up into what it was, having to define it. I think that was the hardest part. Sometimes I would say people would say, "Why Twitter? I don't understand. It's people's breakfast." And I said, "Well, what's on the internet?"
Yeah.
Like everything, I go, yeah,
right.
Exactly. It's the same thing. So
yeah.
But it was interesting that people particularly were irritated.
But the
by
thing,
Twitter.
The thing that I thought, I mean, from the beginning, I thought of Twitter as like a new, kind of like a news feed, because it was people from all around the world just basically reporting what was going around them, and I was like, this is a potentially really valuable thing. I mean, Jack and I even had a meeting with Reuters really early on, and I was telling him about this stuff, and the Reuters guys were like, whoa, let's bring in some of our guys. It's just before the Thomson-Reuters merger, so that we kind of lost that thread. But, there was that. But then there was also the phenomenon of the concept that you could, you know, the watershed moment that I always talk about, where I realized up until this point, Twitter was fun. The point at which I realized I was emotionally invested was when it was a heat wave in Berkeley, and I had watched enough of This Old House when I was a kid to realize that you could rip up the carpeting in your home and reveal the beautiful hardwood floors. And so I started in the middle, and there was no floor there was nothing.
Okay.
And so I'm ruining my house. My 400 square foot crappy house, and I'm ruining it, and I'm sweating, and I'm cursing myself for doing this, and my phone buzzes in my pocket, and it's a tweet from Ev that says, sipping Pinot Noir after a massage in Napa Valley. And I just start laughing out loud at the incongruity of these two things. And so I'm like, and then I realized, I sort of, you know, saw myself from above, and I was like, I'm laughing out loud. This is fantastic. This is what we didn't have at Odeon.
Right.
This is so great. And so it was fun. And then we went, and then in 2007, March 2007, we go to the first South by Southwest.
Right,
thing,
which
like
is where it's
high concentration. It's the first time we see Twitter in the wild, but also high concentration of people using Twitter there. So the story that really, you know, perked me up was the story of the guy who was at the pub at night, that one night, and he really just wanted to talk about projects with colleagues. And so, and the place was too crazy and loud, so we sent out a tweet and said, hey, this place is too loud, let's go to the other place. And he named it. And in the 8 minutes it took him to walk there, it had filled the capacity, line out the door, totally jammed, plan backfired. But it was because he sent out a tweet, and then his followers were like, good idea. They sent out the tweet. And then the other one was like, yeah, good idea. And I was like, wait a minute. There's no other technology that allows people to like kind of swarm like this, you know, and then I always talk about the image of, you know, the idea of a flock of birds in flight. You know, there are a lot of individuals, and then all of a sudden they come in, there's an object, and they become one, and then they become individuals again. And we see this in nature, but this was the first time I was like, I can't think of any other technology that allows this to happen. And so that's when we actually, again, 2 days later, founded Twitter, because that was like, holy crap, this is a party, but what if it had been important or a disaster or something serious?
Mm-hmm. So it became a lot of things later. I think a lot of things hadn't been thought out of what it was exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like it's a dessert topping, it's a floor wax, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, we left.
But a lot of you guys imposed a lot. It's a tool of democracy. It's a this. I don't think any of that probably was thought of when you did it.
Oh, right? No. And in fact, I don't think it would have been appropriate to say things like that. You know, it was one of these things that, you know, I just gave up and started saying it's the messaging system we didn't know we needed until we had it. and we also, we used to tell, you know, new Twitter employees, you know, one of the Twitter assumptions that I used to tell people coming in is, let's just assume we don't know everything, okay? Like, there's a ton of stuff we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And people are going to figure out ways of using Twitter that are going to be like, wow, that's a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
So let's leave that open. The minute we think we know everything, then you're not going to innovate
so
anymore.
So what happened there with you all? You and Evan, it again shifted again. The power dynamic shifted there, and it became a much more serious IPO company. How do you look at that period of what happened there with you?
The period of time where Evan and I were sort of 2 years, just Evan and
mm-hmm.
I?
Yeah, after that. Like what?
Oh, after
what,
that, when Dick
happened,
took over.
Right. What happened to you there?
Well,
and what did you learn from that?
I was still sort of the... You know, basically what I did, what I realized what I was I was kind of the, what Evan referred to as like the soul of the company.
Right.
And I built the brand. You know, I drew the little bird. I built the brand through, you know, hundreds of blog posts and appearances and, you know, framing the company as like a meaningful, you know, I like to say that, you know, Twitter is not to be thought of as a triumph of technology, but a triumph of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, always saying it's what people are doing with this tool. It's not the tool. Like,
right.
Forget the tool.
Yes,
you know, the Berlin Wall could come down and AT&T could have been like, they used phones. You know, like, the phones did it, you know. And, you know, nobody said that, right? And so I built this brand. I built this brand of enduring value. And... And I was the creative guy. And early on, I was sort of designing everything.
Mm-hmm.
But then we hired designers and we did all this stuff. And then Dick was in charge and I wasn't designing anything. And there was a whole product team and everything. And so my job really just became, let's just put Biz on all these TV shows around the world because we get lots of users when Biz goes on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a long time, I was just being like sent to Brazil and stuff. Like, go to Brazil. We'll get a million Brazilians to sign up. And
right.
And so I did that for a long time. And then
you were like the spokesmodel.
But yeah, I was like endorsing it basically.
Right.
And I was like, that was exhausting.
Right.
And then it occurred to me that we had Dick, which, by the way, Evan and I hired Dick. We knew Dick a long time before.
Dick Costolo.
We knew him a super long time. We loved Dick Costolo. Like, we thought he was the greatest. And we were so shocked that he would even come work for us. We were elated.
Mm-hmm.
So funny, so smart. He did all these great things. And we were like, oh my God, he wants to come work for us? That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So, by the time 2011 rolled around, I was like, okay, this Twitter is going to be a timeless company of enduring value. And we have this deep executive bench that's going to take it there. And we have all these incredibly talented people. I felt it was appropriate and okay for me to just go ahead and mm-hmm. start noodling again and figure out... What I wanted to do next.
Was that as tense as has been depicted in other accounts?
Tense?
The tense of the leaving.
For me, that was not tense.
Right.
For me, I just said, hey, I talked to AMAC, and I said, hey, Alexander McGillivray, who was our corporate counsel at the time, and I was like, I'm thinking maybe, I'll, you know, go noodle, you know, go off with Evan and sort of noodle around, and mm-hmm. we're going to restart the obvious thing again. And is that cool? And he was like, sure, if it's cool with Dick. And then... Mm-hmm. And they were like, yeah, but we had this thing. They were like, well, can we call you if we need you and stuff? And so I kept my car, I kept my badge, and I kept my email, and I just sort of like, it was intense.
Was it hard for you to see it go on without you?
No, it was fantastic.
Yeah, well.
In fact, you know,
some people have a problem with it.
Sometimes it's like, Peter Fenton likes to, when we co-teach this class every year at Stanford, and Peter Fenton likes to say that to the class that Twitter shot itself in every major organ and still managed to survive.
I would agree with that.
And so part of me was like, maybe I should just get out of their way.
Right,
like,
yeah.
Don't jinx it.
Right,
like, it's
right,
doing really
true.
Good.
Maybe right.
I should just...
How do you, and we're going to move on to what you're doing right now, and talk a little bit about a few tips, because we have about 10 minutes for Q&A, so come up with questions, everyone. How do you look at it now? What do you think it is now? It's now focused on advertising, television, much more commercial. Well, there is the whole changing the world thing. It's a little less of that and more of
well, that's all happening.
How do you look at the product? How do you see it now? And it's
I now see the product and the company as kind of, this sounds cheesy, but it just went public.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically brand new. So now I'm thinking of Twitter as a company. I'm thinking like decades out. I'm thinking Twitter, you know, Twitter 20 years. Like, you know,
so you think Twitter will be around at 20
years? Yes, I think this, I definitely think that Twitter is going to be a timeless company of enduring value. And GE, did GE have like a bad week or a bad month or a bad, yes. And Twitter's going to have all of that.
So jet engines for you. No, I mean, that's a little
jet
different.
Engines? No, I don't
GE
know.
GE makes jet engines.
Oh, they do?
Yes, they do.
Well, I know they're a big company. But
yeah.
And they've been around a long time. I'm just trying, you know, maybe that's not the best comparison.
Yeah,
but the point is, like, I really do think that there's a ton of value in Twitter.
Okay.
And it's only going to be made more valuable as the team figures out more and more innovative
and
ways
to
partner
to
with
now?
Television and all these
what
cool
is it?
Things.
What is it? Just still the worldwide messaging system? Or what? How would you characterize it now?
I think what Twitter's calling it is the global town square or something like that. But I still think of it as just, you know, this a stream of consciousness from the entire planet, and it gives us a sense of like the pulse of humanity. It's this amazing source of information, and no matter how you slice it and dice it, that's extremely valuable. I mean, almost every important company or deal or business, they're all based on getting information first and fast. And that Twitter's in that business.
Absolutely. So now Jelly.
Yeah.
What's your, you were saying backstage, one of the things that everyone hated Twitter when it first started and everybody kind of liked Jelly.
Well,
so you're
people
worried.
Like thought this idea was good when I was running, you know, I accidentally came up with this idea with my co-founder Ben Finkel, and then I was like, we couldn't get it out of our heads, and I was like, am I crazy? So I ran it by Jack and I ran it by all these people, and they were like, oh my gosh, not only is this a great idea, but it's uniquely suited to you, Biz. You have to do it. And then I got nauseous because I was like, am I really going to do a whole new thing now?
Mm-hmm.
So Jelly, Ben Finkel and I, we realized that no one has, to the best of our knowledge, completely reimagined, in the last 15 years, completely reimagined the way that we get answers to our queries. We've iterated on it, made it faster.
Forms, all kinds, yeah.
But no one said, let's totally new approach. And so... that's what we did. We've designed what we think is a better way to ask a question. It uses pictures, it uses maps, it uses people, most importantly, people from all of your social networks to get you answers to your queries. And, you know, the proverbial 6 degrees of separation, it's been reported, is now 3.8 because of social and mobile.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone on the planet is linked. And we have an opportunity now to create a new way to get answers from real people. And that's potentially a very big, not only is that potentially a very big business to be in, but it's also really what I was saying before about people like business is unique to you. Fundamentally, Jelly is about people helping other people.
Right.
And one of the things I realized about myself that I enjoy doing the most is helping other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why people like Jack said, Biz, this is not only a good idea, but it's literally a productization of your own personality. You have to do it. And there's no way you can go, even if jelly doesn't work, there's no way anyone can say it was a bad idea to create a global system for people to help each other, right?
I mean, come on. Were you worried about?
This is why I'm thinking about the true promise of a connected society. What is it? It's got to be people helping.
How does it differentiate just from the idea? I mean, I know how it does, but can you talk about how? Like, there is Google, which has a lot of answers.
Yeah, and there's information retrieval.
Right.
Of documents that exist.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Jelly,
mm-hmm.
which is saying, I want to know how. Here's a picture of the back of my TV. How do I make this Xbox work?
Mm-hmm.
And someone just circles, well, you got to put this one in here because you got this one. This is your HDMI. Oh, mm-hmm. thanks. Tap the thanks button. Or like, you know, it's uniquely human centric. You know, anything you can see with your eyes, you can ask a picture about it. Thanks to Google and Apple, we have an interactive map of the entire world. Every dentist, every store, every house, every business, you can ask a question about it in Jelly. And then the third one is just this blank box. Just type in a blank box. Very familiar. And but it's going out to real people. It's requesting information from real people. And that's very different because information is transmuted through experience into knowledge. And people can answer questions in such a different way. I mean, you can get things like, you asked me the wrong question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a bad example because maps are great, like on Google and Apple and stuff. But if you just by way of example, hey buddy, where's Howard Street? Well, where are you trying to go? I'm trying to go to the W Hotel. You don't want Howard. Here's what you want to do. You want to go on Market.
Right.
A computer is not going to tell you no. You didn't want to ask me that.
Right. Someday.
But people can do that. Yeah, maybe someday artificial intelligence will get there, but we at Jelly, we're kind of laughing. We're just like, how about just actual intelligence?
Mm-hmm.
What about that?
I was having an interesting discussion with someone at Google, and they were talking about how the machine always beats actual intelligence, no matter how you by.
But it depends what you're talking about. In math. Or,
right.
But if you want to talk about,
they were pretty much saying everything.
I need sunscreen.
Right.
I'm in Dolores Park. Anyone else around here have sunscreen?
Right.
Is the computer going to get you sunscreen?
Presumably not. How is it going?
It's going fantastic. This company seems charmed. I can't believe it. Like, I am so happy. Like, I open my eyes in the morning, and this sounds so cheesy, but I'm like, I get to go to work. I mean, Ben Finkel is hilarious. I knew he was super smart. I'd
mm-hmm.
known him for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea how funny he was.
Mm-hmm.
We almost every other day, we laugh so hard we can't breathe.
How much money have you raised for it?
I don't talk about direct. I never talk about actual direct numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But we've raised an early round and then a second round. First from Spark Capital, Bijan
mm-hmm.
Sabat is on my board.
Same Twitter.
And then we raised from Greylock. And Josh Ellman, who used to work with me on Twitter, is on our board.
Mm-hmm. Could I query Jelly and find out?
You could try.
I bet I could find out in 5 minutes. So
I just don't usually, I never talk about numbers and money.
What's your hope for it?
My hope for Jelly is that it becomes another way to get answers. It's not going to replace anything. It's this whole new thing that helps people get, it helps them get better at work, get better at it helps them through their daily life. Just it helps them. And bigger than that, much bigger than that, again, getting to this hallucinogenic optimism, the idea that if we are successful, we could introduce potentially into the muscle memory of hundreds of millions of people around the world this idea that, hey, there's someone else right now who could use your help.
Mm-hmm.
And if we could do that, maybe we could unlock enough empathy around the world in our lifetime to kind of nudge humanity a little bit forward
to be more
cooperative and thinking of each other.
Before we get to the answers or the audience, what would you say three of the key tips here are from that? You do end on that concept of empathy.
In my book, three tips
yes.
from my book?
Yeah, what would you say? I think you end
well,
on this
I mean,
idea of...
I guess I would say, like, the big things are on creativity, the big thing I learned from Steve was that creativity is a renewable resource. Mm-hmm. First of all, everyone's creative. People sometimes think like, oh, only artists are creative. Everyone's creative, and creativity is a renewable resource. You never run out of it. So that's one. Another thing I would say about opportunity was a key lesson that I learned is people always think about opportunity as the way it's defined, which is a set of circumstances that allow for something to happen. That's fine. That's what the definition mm-hmm. of opportunity is. However, rarely do people back up one step and say, well, what about the circumstances? You can actually architect the circumstances, so therefore opportunity can be manufactured. You don't have to wait for it. You certainly can wait for it or spot it, but you can actually make it. Mm-hmm. So that's another lesson I learned. And then the third lesson, I guess, would be the really important, especially for young people, that there's compound impact in altruism. The earlier you get started with helping people, volunteering, philanthropy, whatever it is, the much more impact you'll have over your lifetime. Most people do it wrong. They wait until they think they're when we're old and comfortable and rich, then we'll throw some money at something.
Right.
And guess what? First of all, you never feel like you have enough. It's mm-hmm. like human nature. And those whole 40 years or however long, you could have been doing great things for people. So mm-hmm. those are three big things
so
I would say.
So start being nice early.
There's a lot I would say about altruism. It's really not, you're gaining something when you're doing something for other
right.
people. You're gaining a whole lot more than you're giving.
So you say that here, the true promise of a connected society is enabling our dormant potential for empathy, correct? This is what you say. It's leveraging all this mobile social connectivity, so helping others becomes as easy as a thumb wipe. Tapping on glass. Jelly may not be the answer or the only answer, but at least it's got the right question guiding it forward. Global empathy is the triumph of humanity.
Yeah.
Now, of course, because I'm disagreeable, I went, ugh, as if, kind of thing.
I know a lot of people are like, oh, yeah. my God, they're rolling their eyes at this guy, and like, you know, come on. But, you know me, so that's how I really think. I mean,
I've perfected the eye roll where you don't see it now.
Oh.
But no, I'm teasing you.
That's why you're wearing the sunglasses.
Yeah, exactly.
Every time you're wearing the sunglasses, you're really going, oh, yeah.
But you feel like that's really the...
When I ask myself the question, what is the true promise? We've become the most connected society we've ever become, we've ever been. What is the true promise of a connected society? Is someone waiting to play letterpress with you right now? Yes, and that's fantastic. But the true promise of a connected society has to be people helping each other so that ultimately humanity, you know, gets to that sort of Gene Roddenberry aspirational view of the future where we don't think of ourselves as citizens of a particular city, state, or country. We think of ourselves as citizens of the world. Mm-hmm. And then we start cooperating together and we do things in 1 year that normally would take 100 years because we finally are cooperating on things. And mm-hmm. different people aren't just constantly reinventing the wheel over and over
right.
again.
It always comes back to Star Trek, doesn't it, with you people?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You people.
You people. And bingo, bango, we have a holodeck. Okay. Questions from the audience. Please get up and go to these. We're going to ask live questions, and you formulate a question and ask one. We're looking for single one-part questions, no lengthy setups or multiple-part questions, please.
Something tells me that the questions in the past have not been the way they like them.
I will handle that.
They're really hitting
right
us home, like
okay.
single question.
Okay, so let's do this. Now we're going to I want to do a reminder. As a reminder to our radio audience, the program is being presented by INFORM, the Commonwealth Club's Innovation Lab. You can find out more information about INFORM and its upcoming events at INFORMSF on Twitter and Facebook. Tonight we're hosting BizStone, Things a Little Bird Told Me, Confessions of the Creative Mind, excuse me. I'm Kara Swisher, co-executive editor of Recode, and we're here with Biz. So let's get to the audience, and remember, we're looking for single one-part questions.
Oh, boy.
Starting.
Hi. My question is, I was hoping you could elaborate more on what your ultimate vision of what connected means. Is it just a social network? Is it just that I have your number? It's just we met once, and we're friends now or followers now?
Yep. This is a thing that people are talking about now. What is the definition of connected? You know, how deep is a digital connection? Exactly. My definition of connected is for the purposes of jelly, and for the purposes of when I talk about we've become the most connected humanity there ever has been, it's these loose connections via social and, you know, our address book and stuff like that. It's not like getting together and having a meal. It's not that kind of connection. However, people have argued that, you know, we're becoming a more disconnected society because of technology, and I don't think that's true. I think we're being introduced to more people around the world. We can you know, view what's happening across the world through someone else's eyes, and people are organizing meetups and spontaneous charitable giving groups and things like this. I think the sort of ethereal electronic connections are what I'm talking about, but I do think that ultimately this leads to real world connections.
Okay. I do.
Thanks. So Clout released a really similar product to Jelly called Cinch right around the same time that Jelly was released. And Jelly has really thrived, and I've seen people adopting it all over the place. Well, where Cinch has really kind of fizzled out. What do you think are the primary things that maybe made Jelly catch on more, just be more attractive to people, be more sticky than Cinch?
I think it's
the name.
Well, don't forget it's named after the jellyfish, which is not, jellyfish is actually the wrong term. They're called jellies. But anyway.
I'm going with the jam, but go ahead.
Yeah. First of all, jelly is still very early. We could, you know, most likely fail. I mean, that's what most startups do, is they fail. So that's still very much on the table. I don't know. I think people, you know, I tend to think it has to do with branding and the way we present ourselves and just that idea of people first, and it's an attitude that is somewhat, you know, it's intangible, but there is something to this idea that, you know, you have this friendly jellyfish logo. We do things like in the first month we worked with Product Red to turn thank you cards into dollar donations to help fight AIDS in Africa. We're planning something similar for next month, a different thing. You know, like the idea of like introducing meaningfulness to just coming to work or just using it. You're just using it. You're just using jelly, and just by doing that, you're actually helping save lives in Africa. I mean, those types of things, I mean, they're very, like I said, intangible, but I think they do go away to helping, and it work. And then again, actually, I shouldn't leave out, of course, the fact that, like, I got all this notoriety from Twitter, so that's a boost, right? I mean, I can't ignore that.
You're the Oscar-winning best supporting actor.
I'm the Oscar, right? But now I'm an actual CEO.
Are you?
Yeah.
So now you've gotten the lead?
Now I have to be, like, much more CEO-ish, and I'm more serious, and I'm a leader.
Mm-hmm. It's totally working for you. Go ahead.
Hi. Biz, I saw your interview last week on the Colbert Report.
Oh, interview.
Not just about your book, but about an incident that happened on his show just a few days before.
Right.
Where a tweet was posted, attributed to him, of a joke he told on the show that was taken out of context, and he slammed him for making a racially insensitive comment about Asians. That was eventually sorted out. It started with a campaign to cancel Colbert, but he eventually apologized and clarified the context of it. This is what we call a Twitter storm, and I wondered if you think that's acceptable. Is that the abuse of the power of the crowd, or is it ultimately the wisdom of the crowd playing out in Twitter
it's
storms?
It's also
like
the
that.
Other side of
well,
Twitter.
Well, a Twitter storm, yeah, it's the like
it really
Paris
is the other
it's the other. What'd you say?
It's the other side of Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. Here's the thing: you can't have a large-scale system of, you know, open communication and freedom of speech without having some negative aspect to it. However, people are basically good, and when you give them the tools to prove that, they'll prove it to you every day. And on all these, on all the large-scale systems that I've participated in, Zanga, Blogger, Twitter, there is way more good than bad. And so you just have to take the good, you just have to take the bad with the good. That means you're successful. I mean, it's just like in real life. There's bad, there's bad. There's way more good people. There's way more people that aren't in jail that are in jail.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So
that's because we haven't gotten to them yet.
Okay. But anyway, I think that's just a fact of like when you build a system with hundreds of millions of people, you're going to have.
I think
some
he does
of
have a point. There's a real ugly. There can be a
of
real.
Course.
Just last week with the Mozilla story, just the
yeah.
stuff I got was astonishing.
Absolutely. I mean, even me, I get nasty stuff sent to me all the time. But that's just, you know, it's a fraction of the of what's going on.
But when it blows up, it certainly does.
Yep.
100%.
I didn't even know what the word Twitter storm was until the Colbert producer said like.
That's a good one.
We got into a Twitter storm, and I was like, what's a Twitter storm? Is that
there's
some
bunches
sort
of
meteorological
yes.
phenomena?
Right, it could be.
All right. What's a daily or weekly habit or tendency that you've, I guess, helps you cultivate your own personal activity over, you know, the course of time?
It's a daily habit. That's a good question.
What's a daily habit that I have?
Yeah, that you've, like, seen as helped cultivate your personal or creativity.
Oh, creativity and things like that. Well, I mean, recently it's become regularly playing with my 2-year-old son. I mean, that's just like, you know, that just brings you back to the childlike joy and wonder of being a kid. And you're just on the floor playing Lego toys and imagining and stuff like that. That's something that I do every morning before work. So that's actually a great thing. So like playing Lego toys and just having fun before you go into work, playing Mickey Mouse Clubhouse and stuff, that gets you in the right frame of mind for like dreaming up new stuff. That's mm-hmm. great. But aside from that, there's like a few things I do. Just to keep it short, I'll say, and a really important part of my life that I've worked in over the years that's really, really helpful is I go on these walk and talks with people that are basically my, I don't know what you want to call it, like my, they're people that I think of as mentors, and it's Jack Dorsey, it's Evan Williams, it's Greg Pass, it's Ben Finkel, who, you know, was on one of these walk and talks where we dreamed up Jelly. I schedule weekly walk and talks with these folks, just because nowadays, I mean, we would hang out normally, but it's so hard that you actually have to schedule it. And we might just joke around, or we might come up with some like really important
Zuckerberg used to do this
stuff. So it's great. It's awesome.
Yeah. Also, Steve Jobs did that a lot.
Because
let's see, quick, 'cause I want to get to everyone. So
thank you.
Go ahead.
Because technology isolates us while it connects us, how do you recommend people divide their time between technology and actual human interaction? Part of a larger question of how do you divide your time online and off?
Yeah. My vision of the future is that we don't see technology just disappears and we interact with each other a lot more. But technology, even though it disappears, isn't gone. It's available all the time to help us and to help bring us together, to help us form more connections, more relationships, help each other, do good things, you know, encourage us to do volunteer work and altruism and be more empathetic people. So I, you know, this comes back to what the word engagement. A lot of technology companies use the word engagement. Some technology, and this can be tricky because you could just say, the people who use our product are engaged, right? But some people say, and some people measure engagement as, oh, our engagement's great. The people who use our product stare at it for 8 hours a day. And other people say, our engagement is great. The people who use our product come back to our site approximately 60 times a day for about 30 seconds, get what they need, and leave. And I think the second measurement of engagement is fantastic. And so I advocate for, you know, trying to get more real time, as much real time as you can.
Do you don't wear a lot of wearables or Google Glass or anything like that? Do you do that?
No, I don't have many of those things.
Would you wear Google Glass?
Not right now, because it would be make me feel really self-conscious, because you can see that you're wearing the whole thing like that. Right. I don't even wear a watch or anything, you know, like, so not yet. I mean, if it was like just my regular glasses, maybe I would, but.
Okay. Last quick question. No, I'm sorry. We only have one more minute, but go ahead here. No. You have to be at the microphone. Sorry, this is the last question, but you can come up to Viz afterwards. Go ahead.
Hi.
Very quickly, because we've got just a minute.
What's your philosophy on exposing children to technology and social media? Does your son have an iPad and a Twitter account?
No Twitter account, because you're not allowed to have a Twitter account unless you're over 13. So I definitely think that for social media type stuff, you know, it should be that stuff. You should have a parent, like, for sure. I'm even careful about, like, when I go to a birthday party or something, and I always ask, is it cool if I... you know, Instagram this picture, because there's other kids in it,
Instagram,
and they might not like it, right?
Yeah.
So, but my son definitely uses a tablet. He loves, like, tracing letters and playing educational games and stuff. I think that's great. I'm not against it.
They're good at it.
He's so good. He does things on the tablet. I was like, how do you do that?
Right.
I didn't know you could do that.
Right.
He goes on there and, like, buys stuff.
Yeah. You heard about my kid, right? He's outside. My kid charged $3,000 in 15 minutes on Clash of Clans. It was quite something.
Did he get in trouble?
Yes, he did. I think I threw him across the room. In any case. But I was also in awe of the ability to do
so.
So it's time for our last question, and it's an informed tradition to ask all of our speakers the following. Viz, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
How long do I have to think about it?
No, don't do a Jack Dorsey on us here, or an Evan Williams. I love that.
What's my 60-second idea to change the world? Oh, boy. How about I just tell you an idea I've had for a super long time that I think somebody should build?
Okay, go ahead, quick. You only have 20 seconds.
Okay,
left.
People don't really, like, go over to their neighbors anymore, knock on the door and say, "Hey, neighbor, what's up?" So, but what you can do is you can actually name your SSID. You can name your Wi-Fi anything you want, and your neighbor has to see it. And it's the only way you can actually force something onto someone else's computer. So, like, I think that we should, I think it would be cool if somebody made something called, like, Neighborly, where you actually could just be like, hey, can you move your car from outside of my driveway? we have an apple tree that our neighbors grow, and the apples fall over on our side of the fence. And I named my Wi-Fi network Yard Apples.
All right. Okay.
And my neighbor, we were emptying the trash together at the same time, and they were like, are you okay with our apple tree? And I was like, yeah, in fact, they named my Wi-Fi network Yard Apples. And they're like, yeah, we saw that. We thought you were angry. And I was like, no, just my wife made a pie out of it, actually.
Right,
so,
okay.
So I think that's...
So it caused
that,
neighborly talking.
That would be cool if more people, like, became more neighborly.
Well, you can change neighborly. It every day. You can change it. Stop putting stuff in my recycling.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
So there's an idea. I don't know. I don't know if it'll change the world. It might change your world.
Do you know, that is the best idea I've heard in a long time. I
like
it. It's a new company.
It's a whole company. It could be a whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So in closing, thank you. Let's give a big round of applause for Viz.
Oh, thank you.
Now this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Viz, three times.
Oh.
Really loud this time. Thank you.
Adjourned.